What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Me, Ellie Gibson, comedian, journalist, and let's be honest, person who drinks too much. I'm on a mission to sort my own shit out, starting with cutting down on the amount of booze I'm necking. Helping me out with this is Stephanie Chivers, coach, trainer, mentor, and supporter of people who want to make alcohol insignificant. Oh, and quickly, shout out to our sponsors, Remedy Kombucha. They make lovely fizzy pop, but anyway, more of that later. Now, I'm very excited to introduce our guest for this episode. She's an author, a campaigner. She's the founder of the world's largest mindful drinking community. And she's even got an MBE, for goodness sake. It's Laura Willoughby. Hello, Laura.
Woo-hoo! Very exciting. Nice to be here.
Oh, which of those accomplishments are you most proud of, Laura?
I don't know. Well, setting up Club Soda is probably it. It's the thing that I did with an idea of my own. You know what it's like when you've got an idea of your own and you decide to run with it? It's quite scary. I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I brought other people in, so I'm not on my own. But I think, you know, taking an idea and making it happen from scratch, quite a big thing.
Indeed.
I recommend it to everybody, though.
Yeah, as long as it's a good idea, not like, you know, robbing a bank or something.
Not a bad idea, just a good idea.
So tell us all about Club Soda. Why did you start it? And was there always a plan? When you started it, did you always imagine it becoming this sort of behemoth it is now?
No, and definitely we're doing things that I never expected we'd be doing at the beginning. So I set up Club Soda in 2015. I gave up drinking myself in 2012 because I was so good at it. When I gave up, I realised there was a big gap for something that felt like a diet club, but with booze, because, you know, you either had to go to AA or local authority services, of which I knew about, but I didn't feel were for me. There wasn't anything that said, you know what, why don't you just get together with a gang of other people, go on a journey together, whether your goal is to cut down or stop for a bit. That's what I wanted to create. And so, you know, I wanted to create a behaviour change, which we have done, and we've got amazing courses. But quite early on, people asked me why there were such poor choices in pubs and bars and restaurants. And I decided that we'd do a bit of research on that. And actually, we did that research in Dalston. We got some funding from Hackney Council, and we did what I call a very big field study, but it's a very posh word for pub crawl. And we went in and looked at and talked to loads of pubs about why they didn't have very good options. And so from that, lots of exciting things happened. I started to talk to the on-trade about that. And then some drinks started to appear to fill that gap in the market. And so then we did our first Mindful Drinking Festival in 2017, and we built a pub guide. And so from that, we've developed into something that's more than just a community about change, but is also an expert on alcohol-free drinks.
There is a contention that I've come across. I don't know how big of an issue it is for you in the field, but I think there are some people who argue, don't they, that if you are trying to stop drinking or reduce drinking, that replacing alcohol with stuff that tastes like alcohol, you're sort of fooling yourself in some way.
Are you, though?
Well, this
I know.
Is it.
I think the answer is no. I think if you find a drink triggers you to want to drink alcohol, then yes, avoid it. But otherwise, these are just drinks. Mm. And in most cases, they're drinks that have got lower in sugar than a soft drink. Think about the amount of sugar in a soft drink. If you're picking up a drink that doesn't have sugar in and doesn't have alcohol in, that's actually even better than having lots of sugar. What I discovered after giving up drinking was that I had this amazing amount of natural energy. And so I just wanted to superpower it with even more. And I really enjoyed the sugar hit. So actually, sugar could actually be a lot more triggering to some people than the taste of something that tastes of alcohol. It's very individual. So of course, I wouldn't say to anybody, you know, if drinking alcohol-free beer makes you want to drink an alcoholic beer, definitely steer clear. But actually, that's not the case for 95% of people.
All right, fair enough. Well, let's go back to the community element then. So Stephanie, obviously you also run a sort of, I was going to say anti-drinking community. That's not right, is it? You'd
no.
hate that. I could see you glaring at me already. You run a community for people who want to change their alcohol use. Why do you think community is so important if you're on this, let's say it, journey?
Yeah, yeah. So community is only a small part of what I do. People like Laura and One Year No Beer are really the big players in that one. It's, I'm more your coach and your therapist, but, and community has happened as an accident, really. That wasn't what I set out to do. But what I found is that people want to speak to each other and share their journeys. That's exactly what they want to do, and get to know each other. And it's actually a really good thing. Although it wasn't something that I set out to do, it is a part of, it's not essential. A lot of people talk about it as being essential. It's not, because not everybody wants to do that. And community is everywhere, isn't it? Like you talked about Slimming World, your running group, you know, your evening class. You can find community anywhere. It doesn't have to be alcohol-free specific. But what is good about, when we're saying alcohol-free, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you and I were talking about that earlier. We're saying alcohol-free, but actually, Laura and I both support reducing and mindful drinking and moderating as well.
Yeah.
But I don't know about you, but I get caught up in saying alcohol-free because it's so trendy, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, it's why we use the word mindful drinking specifically, because actually, if you're still drinking, paying attention to what alcohol you drink is just as important to what you drink on the days that you're not drinking. I use mindful drinking, like you might use the term queer, right? It's a nice, big, embracing a tent. And in our mindful drinking community are also people who've never drunk before, people who don't drink for religious reasons, people who are moderating, people who are driving, people who are pregnant, people who are just want to taste some interesting drinks because they're big old foodies and they like to have the latest thing. That's my community. It's a massive community. In that, we have a subset of people who largely in the communities of change are about going alcohol free. And I think there are some very powerful things in that. But behaviour change is difficult. Alcohol is very social, a very socially used drug. So being able to talk to other people who are maybe a bit further along the journey than you and realise that the sky doesn't fall in when you go out and have an alcohol-free night is a really empowering thing. So you can do that through being in a community and talking to each other, but you can also do that by reading books, listening to podcasts and all of those sorts of things as well. So you do that vicarious learning, which is better for me because, you know, I'm not very good at reading lots of self-help books. I always flip to the end and go, oh yeah, I get it. I get the premise, and then I never do any of the work. So I actually find being in a community where I learn all that stuff by sort of osmosis is quite cool.
Yeah. Is there a tension within the community though? Because I sensed one. So when I sort of started looking at my own alcohol use and thinking, actually, maybe do I need to cut down? I was quite clear from the beginning of like, I was like, I don't think I need to stop drinking altogether, and I don't think I want to. I want it to be part of my life. I just want it to be not as such a big part. And so I started looking online and at podcasts and, at the, you know, for resources. And I found loads of stuff about going sober and never drinking again. And I've been sober for 389 days and all of that. And loads of stuff about, it's 1 o'clock, let's all get shit-faced and pour Prosecco over each other. And I didn't feel that for me, Adrian Charles aside, there was a lot in the middle. And when I would go on things like Club Sober, I'd sometimes felt a bit judged.
It's really difficult because we're generally very binary as a society. You're either drinking or you're not drinking. If you're deciding to go totally alcohol free, then you can count up days, but there isn't the same sort of framework if you're moderating. You can't go, well, I drank yesterday and didn't fall over and smash my nose in, so win. I mean, it,
you don't get a keyring for that.
Keyring or you don't get to tick a little app for that. And it becomes a lot more of a personal journey. And so those people who can claim to be sober or long-term alcohol free, they've got days under their belt, have something very fundamental to hang their achievement on. It feels like an achievement, whereas moderating feels like you're trying to get something in balance. So again, already there isn't any language for you. Drew, my co-founder, is desperately trying to work out some very good language for people moderating. It's a bit like being bisexual in the late 90s, you know. Why, you were snogging a woman on Friday, why are you snogging a man today? I don't understand.
It was a different time.
Yeah, yeah. But people who have had a problem with alcohol and have gone sober for a set amount of time should be really proud of their achievement, right? But it becomes are very much part of their identity. We come across it a lot because we talk about moderation a lot. We'll have low alcohol in the shop, which I know will upset some people. But, you know, those drinks are also important for people to change their drinking habits. Okay. There's a lot more coming out about that. I mean, our book on mindful drinking doesn't tell anybody what their outcome should be. And I think that's really important because actually nearly everything about moderating your drinking is the same as quitting drinking, apart from at some point you're going to have to think a little bit more about what you drink when you are drinking.
Stephanie, do you ever sense that within yours? Because you run quite small groups. Is there ever a bit of judgment from the non-drinkers?
No, but that a key part of that is it's small for starters. So it's easy for me to, you know, run it and keep my message. When you have a big community like Laura's got, it's really, really hard to keep those values at the front of it, isn't it? Not impossible, but it's hard.
You have to work hard on keeping any community you have. You can't just let it, as we know, you can't just let it run on its own. But yes, you have to instill the values, and we try really hard. But at the end of the day, when people have got some days under their belt, they want to shout about it. Yeah. And it will automatically make people who are just exploring moderation feel like they haven't got anything to say.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, because mine is smaller, it's easier for me to manage that. And it's set up right from the beginning, or like Laura's is as well. But I do think the small bit is easy, but it's also about how I run that and facilitate that, which is key. And I support a lot of coaches as well. And they always say to me, oh, isn't it really difficult having alcohol-free people and then having people that are reducing? I'm like, no, you know, because essentially that's what alcohol services do. Alcohol services aren't abstinent based. So for years and years and years and years, well, still is, I hope, people come in because they've got a problem with their drinking and you talk to them about that and you agree a goal and you work with them on that. Now, sometimes that might be about abstinence, but not very often. Mostly it is going to be about reducing. And actually, some people need to reduce as well. So my argument has always been that reducing, moderating, being alcohol free is all part of the same thing, because actually quite often some people will come in and they'll say, I want to reduce my drinking. I'm not ready to be alcohol free. I don't know if I want to be alcohol free. And they might do that for a while, and then they'll do 3 months alcohol free and they might decide they want to be, or vice versa. I've had people that come in and they're like, they'll do a year and then they'll go to occasional drinking. So I think it's really important to keep that conversation open and not, like Laura says, get caught up in those black and white things.
And also decide that because somebody had a drink that they have to be hounded out the group. And
give your keyring back.
Yeah. No, it's definitely not what I want to do, because of course, changing your drinking isn't linear.
Yeah.
You will spend all sorts of time exploring it, and what can affect your drinking can be your life circumstances. My drinking went up when I was in a job that I really hated. Shocker. You know, and it may be that people find not drinking a lot easier during a certain part of their life, and I see people who joined us in 2015 coming back now going, excellent, I did that time alcohol free and then I've drunk a bit, now I'm a bit worried about where it's taking me again, so I'm coming back, I'm reconnecting with the community, and I want to be there for all of that, and not, you know, be hard line.
Do you actively manage, for example, if you're in your Facebook group, for example, if you see sometimes, you know, sober people calling out people who say, I fell off the wagon, or I'm drinking 3 bottles of wine a week or something, how do you go in and moderate that, or do you
we've got some amazing admins who go in and just remind people this is a mindful drinking space. You know, we used to have separate groups, and then what's brilliant about people is everyone identifies differently, so we'd have people giving up drinking in the moderating group and moderators in the alcohol free group, because on most days they were alcohol free. So that just shows you the nature of human beings. And so actually we're one group, a lot easier to manage and keep the culture of that group, but we also make sure that we completely reinforce all of that stuff. And Drew does that very well as well. He runs all of our Wednesday evening workshops and stuff like that, and it's about us continually reinforcing our beliefs as founders. So I'm alcohol free, but my two co-founders still occasionally drink. There are many different ways to moderate, and there's no words for all of that.
I want to talk about then how we sort of got to this place, but I didn't really realise or think about how much alcohol is a part of British culture.
I think you only have to take a small step back to realise how alcocentric a society we are. And it's all sorts of ways. So for example, in Britain, we're taught to stay at events that we don't enjoy by drinking. How about we go home instead. I don't know. It's a radical view. But what we end up doing is we end up going, oh, this is a shit night. Glug, 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 glug. Oh, now I've lost the whole of my weekend. So, you know, giving ourselves permission just to go home is a really radical and, you know, self-empowering act. But yeah, it's a really big culturally, and you don't need to step back very far to see it.
Yes, I mean, as someone who's perpetuated comedy about alcohol for, some would say, years.
Don't forget, we're like the biggest drinking generation of women as well. Mm-hmm. So we have this very unique position because, of course, the children that everyone's bringing up of our generation are drinking a lot less, which may say something about how they feel about their parental drinking.
Yeah.
But there was a perfect storm of things that happened. So I'm 47. There's a perfect storm of things that happened in our teenage and early 20s around gendered socialising, eating out, the availability of wine in supermarkets, and advertising towards women of alcohol, and also that desire that equality meant drinking the blokes under the table, which, you know, I took as a very personal challenge. You know, we're probably the hardest drinking and now the hardest suffering group of women from drinking. And when the media talk to me, they love to talk about, oh, well, Generation Z aren't drinking. Isn't it weird? These young people not drinking. I'm going, no. The average age of customer in our shop is around 40. There's tons and tons of women and they're all changing their drinking. Younger people are drinking less, but our age group are actively changing their drinking from being real hardcore drinkers to not drinking or drinking less because they're really worried about what it's done to their health and their mental health.
Yeah.
And young people are helping us see that a bit because that mental health debate has been really important.
When Helen and I started Scummy Mummies, and actually which we started our friendship, which was around the same time, one of the things we bonded over, to be honest, was alcohol. Was like, oh, we deserve a wine together. I've had a really shit day with the kids, so have I. Come over and we'll have a wine. And when we started the podcast, we always drank. Now we mostly don't. We rarely do. But it was kind of a lot of our friendship and our jokes revolved around that. And as we've got older, we've been together nearly 10 years now. And in the last few years, we've gone, are we the bad guys? It's like that Mitchell and Webb sketch. Are we perpetuating this idea, this wine o'clock thing, this Prosecco's fine, it's fine to be pissed all the time? So we have tried to move away from that. I can't honestly say we don't ever do material about it. We still have some gags in our show about it, but we try and present a more balanced, we try not to endorse it as heavily. But when, are you cross with me, Stephanie?
No, I'm not cross with you, Ellie, and you are not seeing, you're not the cause of all of that. Definitely not. There's a couple of things that really bother me about it, where we're at with alcohol. So one of them is that we say alcohol and drugs when actually it's a drug. And I wish we didn't say alcohol and drugs. That actually drives me nuts because I think that just perpetuates part of the problem. So we have this whole thing where we go, so alcohol is legal and drugs are illegal. And then you've got, drugs are bad. Alcohol is, I would argue, our most harmful substance.
We're really careful about people we let talk about drinking on our website. And I want to know that people always understand that telling people to stop drinking immediately is really, really dangerous.
Yeah.
If they're in any way physically dependent, they could die. That's more dangerous than detoxing from heroin. And everyone goes, really?
Yes.
It's,
you don't
really
die from detox from heroin.
No, but you can die from detoxing from alcohol if your body has become dependent on it. And it's quite hard to tell if you're dependent on alcohol as well. You don't actually have to drink a lot for your body to be dependent on it. Mm-hmm. And the slip from being not dependent to dependent is actually it's a very small hop, skip and jump, basically. And I think I might have got there if I hadn't have stopped when I did. So it's dangerous.
Yeah. I'm not bothered by people having t-shirts done or having a laugh about it. That doesn't bother me at all. What bothers me is it's a drug. Let's see it as a drug. But then also, can we educate people? Now, it is getting better. I do think there's a lot more information out there that's more factual, but that's a very recent thing. Like, it wasn't that long ago that you could see an article that said red wine was good for you.
Yeah. And
which
I think
it's not.
Yeah, it's really important that people get the facts. I do think the stuff that Drink Aware does in particular is really important. I always go, because we only focus on the positives of change. We don't talk about the bad things around alcohol, because generally people who come to us know that already. So that stuff's really important to be there, all that factual stuff. Mm. But I've begun to, you know, as you find new jokes, you know, I like to talk to people about if they're moderating, that they're looking to microdose alcohol.
Yes.
That's basically what you're doing.
Brilliant. Oh, yeah, I love it.
Actually, we should be saying to the government, whether or not drugs are legal or illegal. We have to accept that people will do them. People look for altered mind states. Yep. How do we support people? All of this sits in public health and not in NHS. We've got very poor health economics, very, very poor health economics, particularly for alcohol. And what I mean by that is we have no concept on how much alcohol costs this country because nobody's ever done the maths. We know broadly how much it costs A&E, and that's what the government sticks all of its policies based on. Oh, look, we need to stop more drunk people coming to A&E. But there isn't a part of your body that alcohol doesn't impact on. If you've got any other health condition, anything from acid reflux or poor eyes or even, you know, dental decay.
Skin problems.
There isn't anything that alcohol doesn't make worse. Menopause, actually, alcohol makes a lot worse. There isn't anything that alcohol doesn't make worse. And nobody's ever worked out what that is, including the fact that, you know, if you're continually hungover, the chance of remembering to take your medication are a lot less. So we don't have any health economics. The government isn't able to move funding from A to B and to create some spending pots to allow us to deal with the fact that we've got all these people turning up with mental health issues and we just give them medication and therefore money to the pharmacists, the big pharmacy companies, but we don't ever go, do you know what? Are you still drinking and what are you drinking and how much are you drinking? Because maybe if you drank a little bit less, that may improve your mental health. And by the way, it also improve the impact of your medication because alcohol affects the ability of all your medication to be absorbed properly anyway.
Well, that's, I was going to say, if alcohol is so terrible for us and exacerbates all the problems we have, why doesn't Club Soda push harder for sobriety? Why do you welcome in reduction as well?
Because I don't think, I don't have a goal of making alcohol as illegal as heroin and all the other drugs, because I think we've worked out that prohibition doesn't work. The States is a very good example of that.
We've all seen Bugsy Malone, haven't we?
Yeah. And also, we as human beings, I believe we will always look for ways to change our mind state. And we will always seek to do that. And therefore, how do we create a society which cares for people for whom taking too much of something is causing problems? Mm-hmm. How do we make sure we educate people so they understand what they're putting in their mouth, which includes actually large amounts of foodstuffs that we eat that are also incredibly bad for us? You know, we have strangely drawn lines in society, and actually that's not, you know, the more lines you put around things, the more society rebels against those anyway. So let's look at how we give people the information they need and how we support people when they need it and how we take the money out of the hands of the illegal industry and that illegal drug trade, which is actually causing more of a problem to a larger number of people's lives.
Okay, so here's the thing. When you're trying to drink less booze, you can get a bit fed up of the same old sugary fizzy drink alternatives. I don't have a very sweet tooth, so I know that's the case for me. Which is why I'm a big fan of Remedy Kombucha. Lovely, live-cultured fizzy drinks full of antioxidants and organic acids. They sound good, don't they? The main thing is the drinks are really tasty. Not too sweet, as they don't contain sugar or artificial sweeteners, and there's a range of flavours to choose from, so you won't get bored. Remedy Kombucha, available now from Morrison's, Tesco, Amazon, Ocado, Holland & Barrett, Starbucks, M&S and remedydrinks.com. Cheers! And talking about money then, like, how do you feel about like the cost? Because I know you, Stephanie, ideally you would like alcohol to cost more, which some people, perhaps myself, may balk at slightly.
Yes.
I'd
like to see, I'd like to see people educating themselves and education to be across the board. So yes, we're getting better, but we could do better at it. You know, so better education in schools for starters, you know, things like university. When you go to university, you do an e-learning module on alcohol and drugs. That will save lives. You know, there are quite a few university students around the drinking culture, you know, where they die, you know, from drinking games and stuff like that.
And then falling in the river.
Yeah,
as well.
Accidents.
You know, those sort of things.
Yeah, definitely. Life-changing events. So I would like to see bigger warnings on bottles, and I would like it to cost more, because something when we talk about reducing and moderation is to, it's for people to see it as a luxury item. So we're in this weird situation where people are drinking daily and they think it's okay. It's not unusual for people to be drinking a bottle of wine a day, if not more. And actually, they are putting themselves at quite significant risk around physical health and emotional well-being. The item.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure I totally agree with you, but I'd like there to be some science. Let's have a heated debate.
We found a hot potato.
Well, you know, the Scottish government have brought in minimum unit pricing. There's minimum unit pricing. pricing. And I really hate that policy because it's predicated on a policy that the drinks industry likes, which they love talking about disproportionate health harms, which mm-hmm. is that poorer people, when they drink, get more harm from alcohol because they've got other underlying yes. conditions. But the biggest drinkers in this country are 55-year-old white men mm-hmm. who are rich, basically.
Oh, bloody gammons. There yeah. they go again. So, ruining the party for everyone, as so usual.
We're a bit of an outlier globally. Often in countries, the poorer you are, the more you drink. In Britain, the richer you are, the more you drink. So, of course, all that policy does, that minimum unit pricing policy does, is say, poor people, you can't drink because we think it's more harmful for you because you're poor. But it's okay, rich people, carry on drinking because you've got enough spare cash in your wallet to do that. Those people, if they want to, will carry on drinking. And yet they're the ones who, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why everybody should think about their drinking and not just poor people. The other thing is I think we need to change how we value alcohol, because when you buy an alcoholic drink, the thing that has cost absolutely nothing inside that alcoholic drink is the alcohol. It's a free byproduct of the process that that drink's been through. When people come say to me, oh, why does an alcohol-free drink cost so much? And I say, well, the question you need to ask yourself, bearing in mind that alcohol is free, is why did your alcoholic drink cost so much? Yeah. Because alcohol...
I thought that was a tax thing.
Not really. Even if you took the tax off, mostly what you're paying for is the bottle. And then after that, because alcohol is a flavour enhancer, it makes a very few ingredients go an awfully long way. Ultimately, alcohol's cheapest chips to make, and mostly what you pay for is the marketing. And yes, there is a big bit of tax on that, without a doubt. Alcohol-free drinks, on the other hand, sometimes have to go through an extra process to take the alcohol out. Then you need twice as many ingredients because you don't have alcohol in there to enhance the flavours. Mm. And even the little caps that go on the top, they needing to go through a process to make sure they're clean. Because, of course, the product that goes in the bottle is an alcohol, so it needs preservatives. They really need to make sure that everything is sterilised before an alcohol-free drink goes in there. So it costs an awful lot more to make an alcohol-free drink, even though there isn't any tax. So that just tells you something about the economics of alcohol. And so the question is why do we put so much value onto something that is A, both free, and B, so harmful, that we then, that the only way that we can see of solving this problem is to either put the price up or down or change the pricing of it, when actually we should be saying, you know, if you really care about somebody for a gift, don't go, well, I've bought you the most expensive champagne, which, you know, for every sip might, you know, increase your chances of cancer. Instead go, you know, I've bought you a spa day, which means you can relax and, you know, that'd be really nice. So somehow I think in society we need to rebalance the role that we think alcohol plays and the way that we perceive alcohol as a gift, as a reward, as something that has a high financial value. Like if you're told that it's a free bar, we go mental in Britain. Mental. Ooh, all-inclusive holiday. We don't go, is it all-inclusive in the sausage rolls? We go, is it all-inclusive in the bar? You know, we put such a high value on it, when actually the most expensive thing on an all-inclusive holiday is the non-alcoholic drinks and the fruit and the vegetables. I mean, like most things in public policy, it takes a number of things to change in order for us to push that a bit further. And what's been most interesting, though, since 2015 is a lot of that cultural shift hasn't come from the government or anybody like that. It's come from people sharing their stories and creating more noise about change, and the fact that lots of individuals are changing their behaviour, which meant that there's a market opportunity for people producing drinks in this space. So we are changing our drinking habits in this country despite the government rather than because of it.
I sort of agree with you. I think that's big picture stuff, like the value of it, definitely. But I think how we get there is around restricting advertising, making the labelling better, increasing
the price. But you don't think just putting the price up, well, is like, that was my thought, is that not sort of punishing the poorest in society who maybe aren't necessarily drinking more, but, you know, is it just excluding them?
Yeah, I can see your point. I think the bit that bothers me about that is when you look at cigarettes and what worked with smoking, because that worked very well, was how we changed the packaging and the advertising and we significantly increased the price. And it worked. And then we're into the bigger picture stuff now.
I mean, you're right, because I remember the changes of smoking coming in public places.
Very effective.
But I'm not sure if that's the right shift for something that is quite embedded into our social network. I'd like to see some experiments and some work done on it, and also look at the other changes that need to happen alongside it. I think what's still most fascinating for me is the government is lagging behind on this, and they're not actually using what is a big shift in individuals' behaviour as a way of maximising the potential to help people not drink. You know, I went to speak to Leicester Council, and, you know, there's lots of people who are deeply embedded in drug and alcohol services locally. They haven't seen what's going on. They, you know, I know how much people are buying low and alcohol free drinks. And I did a talk that said to them, you need to push on this open door and see where you can take it, because you could help more people in a more fundamental way, knowing that people are talking about changing their drinking, and what you knew only 3 years ago is very different now. Mm-hmm. And the government is even further behind that. They're failing to capitalize on what is a real a shift in society. And that biggest shift is we're not giving each other shit anymore for not drinking, because by having an alcohol-free beer on draft in a pub means that men no longer take the piss out of men for having a pint of beer. It normalizes an alcohol-free drink. Do not underestimate how powerful that is.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely amazing. And you're right that it's happening from the individual, and that movement stuff, isn't it? Definitely. Yeah. And we can keep pushing that forward. And that's where education is key, isn't it? So the more information that's out there, the more information people can access, and they can make an informed choice, regardless of what policy is doing.
Yeah. And rather than putting money on alcohol, my view is that you should take VAT off alcohol free in pubs, so it takes 20% off immediately, because the sugar tax means that Coca-Cola is a lot more expensive, which is ridiculous, right? I was asked by a journalist the other day. They said, well, the problem is alcohol free drinks are a little bit unhealthy, aren't they? And I said, well, two things you need to know. Unhealthy compared to what? If you're comparing them to alcohol, no, of course they're not. There's nothing you can do in a pub that's as unhealthy as drinking alcohol. And the second is actually adult alcohol-free drinks are made without sugar in and all the other stuff. So actually,
I was surprised when I looked at some alcohol-free beer, like how little carbohydrate was in it.
Yeah,
actually,
because it's three ingredients. Beer's amazing because next to water, it's the healthiest thing you can drink in a pub, right? An alcohol-free beer. Three ingredients, no added sugar, 66 calories, full of vitamin B12. Boom, job done. It's a recovery drink after a run.
Really?
That's how good alcohol-free beer is.
So we've talked a lot about ads and the policy and all that. If you could wave a magic wand, I'd like to ask both of you, actually, maybe starting with you, Laura. If you could wave a magic wand tomorrow and change, you know, stuff, alcohol stuff in this country, what would you do?
I would want the government to do some proper health economics. We had a real understanding of the cost of alcohol in this country, and from that, lots of other things would flow. And then I'd like, and pubs and bars have made a great change in the last few years, but I'd like to see the portion of alcohol free in pubs, bars and restaurants shift significantly. So it's not just one beer and maybe one spirit, but that there's a real shift so that we can normalise the idea that you can still, I don't want people to absent themselves from the pub if they've decided not to drink. I want them to go, oh yeah, I can come to the pub because they've got, you know, Lucky Saint on draft, and they've got Everleaf cocktail behind the bar, or they've got an alcohol-free sparkling wine, which I really quite like. I want people to be able to say yes, not no, to social situations, because they'll always be sure that there's a choice for them.
Stephanie?
I would like to see a lot less advertising, if any advertising at all, actually. I'd go for no advertising on alcohol, maybe up the advertising on alcohol-free and maybe low alcohol. And then I would like to see alcohol being sold in specialist shops. So going backwards, really, rather than it being so readily available. So rather than it being in supermarkets, you know, all that buy one, get one free. You know, when you walk into the supermarket.
They have that in Sweden, I think, don't they?
Sweden and Finland have the Alco shops.
Yeah. Well, you have to go to a specific shop.
Yeah, so you're going to a specific shop, you know, maybe like you would go to a proper wine shop. So you specifically have to go and buy your alcohol in a certain place. It's not so readily available. You're not picking it up from the garage on the way home, or, you know, you've just got to go to Sainsbury's and get something for the kids so you get it. So it's all these small changes, not just one thing, actually. By putting these different bits and pieces in, they're the things that help people to make changes.
I agree with most of both of you, but the idea of having to go to another shop makes me feel very tired.
imagine you might drink less.
Yeah, as for me, I mean, I feel like love finds a way, Stephanie.
I feel like
in the lockdown, when we were trying to really minimise our visits to the supermarket, if going at all, we ended up ordering a lot of wine
online. And then what would happen was, this is when Pete and I, my husband, we got really quite into it, and which is why I had to, ended up having to work with Stephanie, is because we would order wine and then forget to tell each other about it, mainly because we were pissed for most of the day. And then, like, so by the end of the lockdown, we had, it was like an off license. The shed was like a thresher's. There was just crates and crates of wine sort of sitting there. And I remember saying to you, Stephanie, like, oh, we've just got all this. You were like, how much wine have you got in the house? And I was like, oh, mate, it's like one of them shops just outside Calais. And you were like, well, you could give some of it away. I was like, what are you talking about? Are you a millionaire? Yeah, so it's a difficult one. I want to say I agree with you, but I'm lazy. And
but the fact that you think it's difficult means it's a good thing.
She's right. She's just giving you a behaviour change on a plate, yeah. Mate.
Oh, no. We need to have another session. Oh, no.
A chink. And it honestly, those just really little things, they add up.
The whole point of that is it's not just one thing. And there's both public policy and there's personal change. And both are essential.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because that if I had a magic wand, I would invent a drink that gives you the effects, the nice bits of alcohol, the feelings and all of that, but without any of the health side effects. And I'd also like a magic button, perhaps where your navel is, that when you want to not be drunk anymore, you have to like do...
There is another magic button.
Speak for yourself. Some people find that quite hard to find, Stephanie.
It's a very good distraction from drinking.
Yeah, it works.
It's one of my top tips.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Have a little fiddle with yourself.
If you're finding it difficult, you're thinking about drinking, go off and have a wank. It will sort everything.
Yeah, do go off. Don't do it in the middle of a meeting or something like that. Office Christmas party. Don't start putting your hand in your trousers. Well, as usual, as always happens with me, we've successfully managed to lower the tone really successfully. So well done. We've descended into
filth. It's not just me then.
No, oh, God, no. Oh, dear Lord. Made a career out of it. Gosh, we're going to have our whole episode just about wanking now. So, Laura, we like to ask each of our guests who come on the podcast, and yes, I do like to put people on the spot because that's more fun and entertaining, for a nugget of wisdom. So the one piece of advice or information or thing you know now that you wish you'd known 20 years ago, whatever it is, something you want to share with someone who's maybe sober curious or thinking about cutting down on their booze. Give us a nugget.
So I guess my nugget is, you may, as you've got older and you drink more, think that the things that you thought about yourself when you were younger weren't true. So, for example, for me, I always thought my gift in politics was that I was really good at talking to people, working out problems and solving them. And when I was drinking at my most, I felt that I must have been wrong. That wasn't me. I could hardly, because I was continually with a hangover, I wasn't able to concentrate on talking with people. I could hardly look people in the eye when I was talking to them. And I began to think I wasn't a people person anymore. And then I gave up drinking and it all came back. All those little mini interactions. I am that person who will speak to you on the tube, all of those things. But all of those mini interactions and talking to people came back. And I realized that I had been buried under that for a very long time. Drinking had buried the true essence of who I was for a very long time. So don't see changing alcohol as taking away something for your life, but maybe about thinking about the life you want to lead and the things about yourself that you thought you were that you may want to regain. Because for me, I definitely regained my values and who I was as a person when I gave up drinking. So don't see it as giving up something and mourn it as such. See it as about rediscovering who you are. Mm. Although I also thought that improving my memory and sleeping with inappropriate people would get better with giving up drinking, but those have remained exactly the same.
Mm. Well, Stephanie, follow that. You've got a nugget.
Well, my nugget, I've said it already, is educate yourself. Read Drink by Professor David Nutt, because then you can make an informed choice about what you're doing with your body and your brain.
Indeed. David Nutt, famous podcast guest on Sort Your Shit Out. What would you like to plug, Laura?
Well, I'd like to plug you all coming to the tasting rooms, 39 Drury Lane. You can find details on joinclubsoda.com and, you know, do engage with us. Our whole point of Club Soda is about people discovering alcohol-free drinks so you can make a switch, basically, which is a very powerful behaviour change tool in its own right. Swapping an alcoholic drink for an alcohol-free one is probably one of the easiest things that you can do. And we've got you covered. It's called the tasting rooms for a very particular reason, which is that for people who may not have tried any alcohol free before, you want to find out what you like, right? So you can come in, you can try stuff. We've got a cocktail bar. You can come and sit until 10 p.m. on a Thursday, Friday and Saturday evening. We do cocktail classes and wine classes and all of that sort of stuff that you'd expect from a traditional off license, but better.
Thank you so much for listening to Sort Your Shit Out. Next time, we'll be talking to Kat Sims, also known as Not So Smug Now on Instagram. She'll tell us why she decided stopping drinking altogether was the right choice for her and what has helped her along the way. Cheers! Follow us on social media. We're at SISO Podcast on Instagram, that's S-Y-S-O Podcast, or just at SISO Pod on Twitter and Facebook. Sort Your Shit Out was devised and presented by me, Ellie Gibson, with Stephanie Chivers. The music is by John Thorne and it was produced by Laura Grimshaw. Thank you to Remedy Kombucha for sponsoring the podcast. For more information, go to remedydrinks.com.